Hi, thank you all for being here with us in our challenge, Balance Unbalanced. My name is Tommy Ayala, and I'm currently here with my co-host, Tarek El Hout, and with a special guest today, Roger Molina. How are you doing, Roger?
I'm doing fine. I'm speaking to you from Dallas during Texas Thanksgiving.
Great,
Happy
great.
Thanksgiving.
So yes, today, as you may know, Balance Unbalanced is mainly concerned with environmental factors. And our mission is to see how artists can actually help provoke a message of concern towards our environment. Roger, you have an interesting history with our director Ricardo Del Fara and Balance and Bias in general. Would you give us a brief history of what's going on with you and Balance and Bias?
Okay, so I guess that goes back several decades. As you know, or maybe the listeners don't know, I'm the editor of a scholarly journal called Leonardo. And from very early on, we've published the work of artists involved in environmental issues. And I would just mention Helen and Newton Harrison, who are amazing artists. Unfortunately, Helen just died recently. But they published extensively in the 1970s in Leonardo, before the Green Movement, as it's called now, started. Also, Drew Hammond in England started a section called Environment 2.0, addressing exactly what you're talking about. How do we rethink what we're talking about here and the impact of humans on the planet, but also of the impact of other things on the planet? So when Ricardo started the Balance Unbalanced, I was very enthusiastic. We were in touch with a community of practice of artists that were addressing these topics in very different kinds of ways and methodologies and from different viewpoints. And recently, I've been talking about the concept of a network of villages. And so for me, Balance Unbalanced and the way it brings people together is like a village. It's always done on a scale where actually you can do something productive, whereas big events are great. I've been to the Rolling Stones concerts, but I'm not sure we had any particularly new ideas then. And so, how artists get involved in these issues is a interesting thing. And I think what people don't understand is many artists are more literate scientifically and technically than most scientists, actually, and most educated people. And so I think they have a unique perspective to bring.
Okay, that's great because we know from previous experience that you give a big importance to multidisciplinary tasks, transdisciplinary work. And so is this how you think like artists can actually help a bigger community like scientists and other environmentalists to work this issue?
Okay, so let me ask you both a question. You're in Toronto right now.
We're in Montreal.
What are there any endangered species within 100 miles of you?
Endangered species around 100 miles.
Or threatened in ecologies or
Of course.
I would say bears.
Yeah.
Bird.
yep. Especially migrating birds, obviously, which have a huge importance. So let me assure you, what are the migrating birds in Toronto? Ducks. We get a lot of migrating birds here in Texas. But so the way I like to put it is, those birds don't care whether you're an artist or a scientist or a politician or an engineer. What the bird's hoping is that you're going to do things that help them survive. Now, the only people on the planet that define things so narrowly in disciplines are universities. And I have this phrase that I have to be careful since this is public, that universities are stupid. They're still organized in the way that was set up hundreds of years ago, where people work in disciplinary ways on problems which require very different approaches to solve. And obviously, the kind of crises, overused word, the kind of things that you're talking about need different approaches. And it's a combination of scientific, artistic, political, economic, with the key problem that we need to redesign our culture. right? Our culture is unsustainable. We understand that. No culture has ever redesigned itself in human history.
Yeah.
When things got tough, they moved. So when North Africa got dry, all the Tuaregs moved to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Well, we have nowhere to move to, although I know you wanted to talk to me about space exploration. We can talk about that perspective also. How do you redesign a culture? From my point of view, artists and designers are key people in that process. Lots of other people are key people too.
Okay, so you actually have faith in, for example, re-education of the population, because most of people believe that if we manage to change actually something, it might be through technology. Very few people believe that we will actually be able to change the mentality and the way we use resources, the way we manage resources. Do you actually believe that we can be able to reshape our culture so that we can preserve our planet?
Okay, so, you know, this could be a 3-hour podcast at this rate.
Yeah.
Let me just give you an example. Next week, I'm going to Paris to the NSAD, the School of Art and Design, and I'm on a PhD committee for a young designer, artist designer, who has a project in Madagascar where they're working with very poor people that go through garbage piles, separating the recyclables from the trash, so that then the plastic bottles then get sent to a plastic bottle making factory. And so what they're doing is getting the poor people who are working sorting the trash actually also to work in the factory so they can see the whole process of how recycled plastic becomes a new bottle.
Okay.
And part of the problem is the things we do that are destroying our environment are essentially invisible to us. You know, we don't know the impact of drinking plastic in plastic bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of the problem is how, and I call this intimate science or making science intimate, how do we become aware of the things that are happening when our senses don't have any connection to it, right? We can't smell CO2,
mm-hmm.
but it's a gas that traps heat in the Earth's atmosphere. Yeah. So, you know, this whole process now, maybe this process is too slow that it's too late. You know, the combination of the population explosion and the impact on the environment means that half the Earth's population will die, like in the Black Plague in Europe when they didn't know how to solve the Black Plague. They invented hygiene in that time period, and mm-hmm. that helped, but it took a long time. So, yes,
yeah.
Redesigning a culture is non-trivial, and my green friends in Europe, when I was working for the French Space Agency, I would go to them and say, you know, we want to help solve the environmental crisis. And they say, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution. And so, indeed, a space agency tends to be technology driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have all these amazing satellites and things. Let us help you. And the green movement's attitude was, well, actually, the way you work is part of the problem, which is you're building space debris right now. So mm-hmm. the Earth is now surrounded by broken satellites and junk, which are now dangerous for other satellites. So the space business didn't care about their trash.
Okay, I see.
The way they function is part of the problem.
Yeah, as you said before, there are problems that we are not aware of. But I think there are problems that most people are aware of, but they are not taking initiative, maybe because they're lazy or they just don't care.
Yeah, and there, you know, I'm just going to go back into my network of villages metaphor. If the three of us can't figure out how to do it, why should we convince anybody else? And so how small groups of people work together, you know, part of it is an awareness thing. As I said, our senses don't detect climate change, not directly. So part of it is how do the students in my research lab here deal with the problem? And I hate to tell you, my carbon footprint is terrible this year because I've flown to about 20 cities around the planet for conferences. Yeah. I'm having an impact that's disproportionate, and certainly poor people have less impact than I do as someone who's traveling around giving talks at conferences.
Yes, we recently talked to a lady also who was concerned about the effects of taking the plane often, because she told her that that was her major dilemma right now, which, like you, makes increase her carbon footprint in a quite important way compared to her other habits also.
Would you think of doing something like this, like take a big step and stop taking a plane?
Okay, so, I used to have this cell phone app, and I haven't used it for 2 or 3 years, which would calculate my carbon footprint. You know, I live in a city that's a driving city, Dallas. Everybody drives everywhere in a car that has one person in it that's unused all night and most of the day. So basically, you own a car for 2 hours. You need 2 hours of transport. Clearly, there are ways of changing your behavior. Maybe some of these new kinds of ways of thinking about how you use vehicles or planes might make sense. But then, you know, it's sort of an education looking at your own carbon footprint. I'm about to eat turkey this Thursday. We raise turkeys for 1 week in the year in America. huge overproduction of turkeys. What's the carbon footprint of eating one turkey? And I don't know because I don't have my cell phone app. But so part of the problem is understanding one's total carbon footprint. So it's easy to point at airplanes and driving, but what about all the other things?
Yeah.
Now, maybe putting a city in a place which climate change is going to affect. So California is going through a crisis right now of forest fires. Mm-hmm. Maybe we shouldn't be building houses in forests. That's going to help all the people in California that love living in forests. Then you're creating a risk of huge forest fires. And I think right now, 80% of forest fires in California are triggered by human activity, not by natural causes.
Yes, totally. That's a great point. And unfortunately, it's a very important fire. But it's, like you said, it's not the first time that happens.
Another example is in Texas, we've had all these big storms in the Gulf of Mexico, flooding towns on the coast. We know sea level is rising. Why do we keep rebuilding houses on the coast, which are going to be flooded within the next 100 years? Right. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, it becomes really tough. How does a city decide what permits it gives for new construction? And maybe that's a much bigger impact than my own personal carbon footprint. And I'd have to sit down and do the calculations. But sea rise is happening, and yet we're rebuilding houses in places that just got flooded.
What do you think right now is the major problem? Your number one problem that you think that needs to be solved right now?
Oh. For me, it's easy that we don't understand the impact individually that we're having. Now, that's where I think artists do play a role. There are a number of artist projects that I always like to cite, including the artist in New York created this wearable textiles, this T-shirt that would turn red whenever the pollution level was too high. And let me tell you, if you were in a subway and everybody's T-shirt turned red, you'd get the hell out of there. You know, you cannot smell most pollutants. I mean, obviously, particulates are a problem. But many of the gases are changing their composition in the atmosphere. We can't sense. You know, there's an example of an artist, and unfortunately, I don't think she was able to start a company and sell them successfully, where your T-shirt would tell you that the CO2 level was different than it was last year. And, you know, how do we become aware of the impact we're having individually, but also in small communities? And so I think for me, that's one area that artists can sensitize us more directly to what we're doing.
Okay, I see. Roger, we're actually running out of time, unfortunately, and this could have gone, like you said, for 3 hours. But let me just ask you a question. Leave us on the answer. We'll think about it and probably come back at it later. You said when we had a problem, we used to change places, run away. Do you think this time we'll actually be able to use space exploration and to run away from our actual environmental issues?
Okay, so I think the most useful thing space exploration can do is observe our own planet and help us mitigate climate change. Human beings evolved in one gravity in a terrestrial atmosphere. I don't believe human migration to other planets can be done on a timescale relevant to what we're talking about.
Okay.
If you wanted to talk about a 10,000 year timescale, I'd be happy to discuss how to redesign human beings to survive in zero gravity, and how to live in igloos, all over this, the universe. So I'm very upset about the space tourism discussion that's going on, thanks to Mr. EM, and I won't pronounce his name either. Let me tell you, the moon is a very boring place compared to the jungles of Colombia. You might go to the moon once to play golf, but that whole industry, and I'm very sad that he's paying for artists to go around the moon. Rather than spending that money on having artists involved in the environmental movement, maybe using space assets as part of that. And there are very many interesting space artists that have been wrestling with how to work in space exploration to help us survive on this planet.
Okay. That was interesting. Well, thank you, Roger, for being with us today here at Balance and Balance. We hope to hear more from you soon. I guess people here on Creative Disturbance know about you and know where to find you. But if they don't, you can find about Roger all over the website. Is there anything else you wanted to share with the people before?
People looking me, I try and make sure all my talks are up on YouTube and all my slideshows are up on SlideShare. So if you're actually looking interested in what I'm thinking and worrying about at the moment, that's the best place to get my what I'm up to.
Okay. So thank you very much, Roger. We hope to be in touch soon again.
Always a pleasure, Roger. Thank you.